This is a not at all rhetorical question. What happens to this economy if we're not a democracy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, January 6th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The story of the day today, obviously, is the story of this day a year ago. And that story is not, on the face of it, ours. Except it is. Last year, as the insurrection was still happening, I talked to Wendy Edelberg. She is the director of the Hamilton Project, also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And we talked to her about what the events of that day would mean for the economy. And we have gotten her back on the phone today to see where she stands. Wendy Edelberg, it's good to have you back on.
Very happy to be here.
So I went back and I listened to our conversation from a year ago today. And you were, we were all shocked, but you were concerned, I think, about what the events of this day a year ago were going to mean for the American economy. And I imagine you've been thinking about it since. Where are you on that?
Yeah, I listened to that interview as well, and I sounded pretty shaken up.
Yeah.
Last year at this time, I was worried we were seeing evidence that political instability could derail the recovery. And we have certainly seen ways that it slowed the recovery. I mean, vaccine hesitancy, not taking the necessary steps to make sure that schools and workplaces are safe, coming to the precipice on a debt ceiling crisis. Those problems have led to fits and starts in this recovery.
We talked, though, you and I that day about the rule of law and how essential it is to the things that make American capitalism, for all of its well-acknowledged flaws, and there are many. The rule of law makes this economy work, and I don't know that we're seeing yet the economic impact of the tearing down of rule of law that the 6th of January represents. You?
Yes, it's not my area of expertise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I certainly think a lot of the implications are still ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's going to influence the conversation that we have over the next year going into the midterms and how we govern ourselves when we don't have united government.
Well, let me get it to your area of expertise then and put it in finance and economics and business language, right? Stability, confidence, trust in regulation, those kinds of things seem to have been a year ago in peril. And to your point, I guess the biggest effects are yet to come.
I mean, one of the most concrete examples of how unhelpful these sorts of problems are is the debt ceiling crisis. We came up to the precipice of an all-out crisis for no good reason other than political chaos. There was no bargaining going on. It was simply creating chaos that was completely preventable.
Well, one of the things you said a year ago was that, you know, you said, this happened. You can't unring this bell. And I wonder if the Republicans, in trying to memory hole the lying and the deceit and the violence, are actually succeeding in unringing the bell.
That's a depressing thought. There's a very 1984 aspect mm-hmm. to that. It's very unnerving what happened a year ago. I mean, the reason I keep thinking about how this is going to affect the year ahead mm-hmm. is because it had everything to do with our election process and, change in power from one political party to another political party. And so it makes me nervous for the year ahead. I don't think our country has an amazing ability to forget. It would surprise me if we forget this.
I'm gonna misquote Joe and Lai here on the way out, but I wonder if it's too soon to understand the economic legacy of the 6th of January, 2021.
Yeah, I think it is too soon.
Yeah.
And it will be colored by everything that's happened to the economy because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so much is good about the recovery over the last year. We've seen real wage growth for the lowest wage workers. We've seen a very strong labor market, stronger household balance sheets, a big decline in the poverty rate, which is partly a result of policies that were enacted over the last year. And at the same time, we're still in the midst of chaos. We have a disruptive composition of consumer spending. Real spending on goods is 9% above trend. The goods sector is buckling under the pressure with goods price inflation running at 12%. So I'm not sure how we're going to disentangle how much is a result of our political process, how much is a result of the pandemic, and indeed how those two things have been completely intertwined.
Wendy Edelberg is the director of the Hamilton Project, also a senior fellow at Brookings. Wendy, thanks a lot for your time and your thought and your expertise.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Up the eastern seaboard at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan on this day 1 year later, traders were not quite so optimistic as they were last year. If you remember, markets were up last year on the 6th of January. Details, numbers, you know the drill. A real estate data company called Atom, A-T-T-O-M, that had a report out today on rent affordability. The TLDR, which we have talked about in the past, is that both rents and home prices are up. Yes, but you scroll through that report and there is a relevant detail that's not getting a whole lot of real estate news attention. In much of this country, wage increases are outpacing those rent increases. Much of the country, not all, as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports.
In Boise, Idaho, the cost of housing is a lot higher than it was when I was growing up there. Since early 2020, home prices and rents have increased 30 to 40%. Boise is one place where housing costs and wages are not rising in sync.
No wages are going to go up that much. It just doesn't happen that quickly.
Todd Tita is with Atom Data Solutions. Still, he says, nationwide, it's a different story.
Wages did grow nicely in a lot of parts of the U.S., right around 8% on average.
But that growth has been driven by pandemic-caused labor market weirdness. Alicia Mazar with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says it's usually the other way around.
You have this long-standing historical trend, right, of rent rising faster than renters' incomes.
Mazar says since 2001, rents have gone up by 15%, adjusted for inflation. And whether renters will be able to make up that gap partly depends on where they live and whether their raises are substantial enough to keep up. In Burbank, California, video game programmer Elon Ruskin's raise was not.
This year, my rent went up 5% and my wages went up just over 2%.
Ruskin would like to buy a place, but that might make more sense if he leaves California for a part of the country, like the Midwest or the South, where, according to Adam, it's more affordable to buy than to rent. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
So we talked just a little bit yesterday about the Federal Reserve and how it's pretty much decided to stop keeping interest rates low as inflation proves to be non-transitory. Wall Street hated that yesterday. They hated it today. Also, though, not terribly fond of the newly hawkish Fed, cryptocurrency traders. Bitcoin, Ether, all the big ones down yesterday and today. And look, yes, crypto is volatile to begin with. And the crypto converted say, hey, Bitcoin and the rest don't follow the normal rules of currencies and stocks. But it kind of looks like in these inflationary times, they kind of do. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on it.
For some people, cryptocurrencies are like gold, a place to store and protect their money.
As a hedge against inflation.
Christopher Vecchio is a senior strategist with Daily FX. The Fed yesterday, we learned, was getting ready to be real aggressive in fighting inflation.
Well, with expected inflation measures falling, if that is one of the reasons why people have been investing in cryptocurrency, then there's less of a need.
So in that way, crypto's been acting like gold, and the price came down. Now, for some people, crypto isn't about inflation. It's really just gambling, like long-term gambling. James Angel is a professor of finance at Georgetown.
Most of the value propositions are for things 30 years from now. That means the payoff is long in the future.
But when interest rates suddenly rise in the here and now, long-term bets look less attractive. And in this way, crypto's acting a lot like those high-flying tech stocks on the NASDAQ. They, too, had big dreams long in the future, and investors got a little tired of the pie in the sky. Speaking of broken dreams, when the market takes a tumble, it also means
less money for people to play with in the crypto market.
In fact, when things go sour in the broader market, people will take money out of crypto to save themselves, especially when markets close for the day. Stéphane Ouellette is CEO of FRNT Financial.
Just in our modeling, clear correlations around accelerated sell-offs following North American equity market hours.
So in that way, cryptocurrency is acting a lot like maybe the oldest investment, a wad of cash under the mattress for emergencies. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Couldn't cook the turkey, so we put it on the barbecue.
Really? All right. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 170 points today, nearly 0.5%, 36,236. The NASDAQ down 19, about 0.1%, 15,080. The S&P 500 shaved off 4 points, about 0.1%, 46.96 there. French data privacy regulators have fined Google and Facebook, saying the companies made it too hard for users to opt out of being tracked by those infamous cookies. Google was fined 150 million euros, Facebook 60 million. Google parent company Alphabet, basically unchanged on that news because, honestly, pocket change. Facebook's parent company Meta picked up 2.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.72%. I think we ought to round up. Last I saw was 1.725, actually. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wendy Edelberg was talking about this up at the top of the program today, that despite all of the bad things associated with this day a year ago, there's a bunch of pretty positive signs in this economy right now. How easy it is to get a job. How many of those jobs are offering signing bonuses. How much people are spending. All of which suggest things are in pretty good shape. But if you ask people how they are feeling economically, and it's not positive. The New York Federal Reserve says a growing number of people think they are worse off now financially than they were a year ago. And the number of people who say things are going to get better over the next year is shrinking. So we asked Marketplace's Justin Ho to figure out what gives.
The disconnect starts with inflation. Tim Dewey is an economics professor at the University of Oregon. He says higher prices make people nervous about the economy.
It feels like something's wrong.
Dewey says that's because most people just aren't used to seeing prices rise like they have this year.
You know, we haven't had an outbreak of inflation like this since the 1980s. That's, I think, something that certainly caught a lot of people by surprise.
But people's personal perception of how much inflation there is tends not to be very accurate.
We do know people tend to perceive inflation higher than the actual inflation.
Nan Li is a senior economist with the International Monetary Fund. Back in 2014, she did some research on why people worry about inflation. She found that people tend to base their judgment on items they buy frequently, like gasoline, for instance.
At the time, gasoline price was high, and we do see in the news that people were quite nervous about inflation.
Thing is, the inflation rate in 2014 was less than 1%. At the same time, other products people were buying, like TVs, had been getting cheaper and cheaper.
But since you're paying more attention to fuel just because of your shopping experience, that will bias your perception of the overall inflation.
Lately, people have had plenty of rising prices to fixate on. Gas, furniture, sporting goods, groceries.
And the problem is that people have a harder time putting rising prices in the context of the broader economy.
That's economist Betsy Stevenson at the University of Michigan. She says although prices are rising, so are wages, especially in low-wage industries like food and accommodation.
When a company moves from paying $10 an hour to paying $12 an hour, that's a 20% increase in wages. We don't see that very often.
And people in the bottom third of incomes are more optimistic about the economy, according to surveys by the University of Michigan. But Stevenson says people in the middle third haven't seen the same wage gains.
Things are getting more expensive for them and their wages aren't quite keeping up. And I think that's where you're seeing some of the pain from households who are saying, you know, hey, I'm worse off than I was a year ago.
But as pessimistic as consumers may be, their feelings don't have as much of an impact on the economy as what they actually do, says economist Shannon Seery at Wells Fargo.
I think the biggest concern about this disconnect today in terms of consumers being downbeat is that consumers pull back on spending and that leads to, you know, a more downbeat outlook.
But so far, consumers are still spending a lot.
If consumers are as pessimistic as some of these headline measures of confidence are suggesting, then they would have pulled back in spending more than they have.
It doesn't help that we remain in a pandemic and going into a winter with a highly contagious variant running rampant. Economist Claudia Somm at the Jane Family Institute says, unlike previous waves of COVID,
families, small businesses, communities are going into this without the same level of economic relief that they have in prior waves.
Like federal relief checks, additional unemployment benefits, and the expanded child tax credit. Somm says the good news is that those things gave us a blueprint for avoiding economic disruption.
But there is a fatigue and a fatigue among policymakers that is not going to help us get through this winter. And people are going to be even gloomier about what we're headed towards. And that is absolutely justified.
Even though right now the economy is looking good. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Among the many parts of this economy that are looking at the Omicron wave and saying, no, come on, are you kidding me? The conference and festival industries are leading the way. They were just starting to make a comeback when Delta hit, and now they're having to scale back or straight up cancel again. And this is an instance where trickle-down actually holds true, because beyond the events themselves, the local economies of the host cities suffer as well. The Sundance Film Festival, just for instance, was set to make a return to Park City, Utah at the end of the month. And then yesterday, organizers canceled all of the in-person screenings and events. Marketplace's Savannah Marr takes it from there.
Park City businesses have been prepping for the return of Sundance for months. Casey Metker's bartending service, called Top Shelf Utah, was hiring extra staff, stocking up on inventory.
Good thing wine gets better with age, right?
Metzger says moving the event online was the right call, but it still stings. Sundance Week typically brings in a third of his annual revenue.
It's a blow. There's no doubt about it. It's going to be tough to manage because you're so close, right?
This kind of uncertainty is hard on local economies, according to Roberto Cross, who studies tourism economics at the University of Central Florida.
Very few destinations expected a fourth wave, and the Omicron right now is creating havoc throughout the industry.
Travelers are canceling hotel reservations, events are canceling venue and catering contracts. Dan Howard with Park City's Chamber of Commerce says its economy will weather this storm, just like it did last year when film buffs were replaced by skiers.
The people who did visit Park City during the 10 days that would have been Sundance were very impactful economically.
The difference this year is that businesses only have 2 weeks to pivot.
It's a devastating loss.
Stephanie Samuels manages Park City Peaks Hotel, which suddenly has a lot of rooms to fill.
We went from sold out down to about 9% occupancy.
But if you're booking a last-minute vacation to Park City, you can probably get a great rate on a hotel room. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
California fire investigators made it official this week. Downed power lines and failed equipment started last year's million-acre Dixie Fire. The worst wildfire in this state's history, the Camp Fire in 2018, was started by a part of the power grid that was 97 years old. And as a result, utilities out here have started shutting off power to up to a million customers at a time during peak fire weather. And there is a push now to force those companies to keep an inventory of their oldest equipment. From Acton, California, Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more.
Residents here have stories about the power going off at the most inopportune times, like Thanksgiving Day 2020.
I have an electric oven. Couldn't cook the turkey, so we put it on the barbecue. It came out really good, but it was just different.
Jan Brown runs a print shop in Acton. Many in this small town of 7,400 on the mountainous northern edge of L.A. County can relate. In 2020, their utility, Southern California Edison, cut power almost 300 times in the region, parts of it in fire country. The blackouts were scary and could be dangerous, but Brown knew things could be worse.
My thoughts went to the people up in Paradise that just were totally devastated.
Paradise is the Northern California town destroyed in the 2018 campfire. It started when a century-old hook snapped, causing sparks to fall onto dry brush below. Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, pleaded guilty to killing 84 people and starting the fire. Then CEO Bill Johnson spoke at the sentencing hearing in 2020.
I wish there was some way to take back what happened or to take away the impact, the pain that these people have suffered, but I know that can't be done.
In a law passed months after the campfire, California created a new wildfire safety division and appointed a board of experts to advise it. Meanwhile, the utilities have been making upgrades to their systems. In the fall, these contractors in Acton were breaking ground, re-anchoring a pole that suspends power lines above a highway overpass. The Wildfire Safety Advisory Board is pushing for more, recommending utilities start tracking their oldest equipment. They've zeroed in on a regulation called General Order 95, which governs how California's power lines are built and maintained. The order is 80 years old and says it doesn't necessarily apply to equipment built before it took effect. In an email, the advisory board's former chairwoman, Marcy Edwards, told Marketplace this old electrical infrastructure is some of the state's riskiest, like that 97-year-old hook just outside of Paradise. PG&E and SoCal Edison say they don't factor age into their equipment inspections. Raymond Fougere is a principal manager with SoCal Edison.
We treat it all the same. If they see something that needs repair, we will document it and schedule it for repair.
But both SoCal Edison and PG&E, the state's two largest utilities, each told Marketplace they aren't keeping lists of the exempt equipment that's over 80 years old. That surprises Joe Mitchell, one half of a husband and wife team of wildfire safety advocates.
I would have thought that after the fires, there would have been more effort to do a historical survey.
His wife, Diane Conklin, a lawyer, says the utilities have avoided doing that for a long time.
If you don't know what your problems are, then guess what? You don't have to solve them.
This isn't just a problem in California. Across the country, power companies have long run their equipment until it fails, says Michael Wara, who directs Stanford's Climate and Energy Policy Program. Now, he says California is moving towards a system of fixing things before they fall apart.
More like how commercial aircraft are operated, where it's not okay for a jet engine to break while in flight. And so the components of the jet engine are maintained and serviced and replaced long before they wear out.
As these repairs and upgrades take effect, residents in Acton are noticing that there are fewer utility-led power shutoffs these days, but they'll still be a part of life in California for a long time. In Acton, California, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's more of a thought, actually, and I don't want to belabor the point, but I meant what I said in the open. The American brand of capitalism, which we all know is miles and miles and miles from perfect, it depends on America being and acting like a democracy. That's it. That's what I got. Okay. We're going. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.